Welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Norma Walden, Chair of the Club's International Relations Forum. We welcome our audiences here and on radio and invite everyone to visit us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. It is my pleasure to introduce our speaker, Dr. James Forcier, Assistant Professor at the University of San Francisco and Director of their Applied Economics Program. In addition to his responsibilities at USF, Dr. Forcier is Managing Director of the business strategy consultancy Bay Analytics, whose clients include AT&T, Charles Schwab, Cisco Systems, Comcast, and Visa. He has been CEO of Allion Pharmaceuticals and the Holtz Corporation, Director of Strategic Technology at AirTouch Communications, and Technology Finance Director at Stanford University. You may have seen and heard him in appearances on Fox News, MSNBC, recently the Ron Owens Show on KGO, National Public Radio, and NBC Nightly News. Some of you will recall that James volunteered here at the Commonwealth Club as chair of our business forum for several years. Please welcome James Forcier to discuss Groundhog Day economics. Why do we keep making the same mistakes?
Well, thank you very much for coming out on this warm Monday in San Francisco and satisfying your interest in what Groundhog Day economics might be all about. We've got a nice group here, and I'm grateful for your being here, including a couple of my former students who must be particularly resilient in the economics department to put up with me yet again. You may have heard that economics is sometimes called the dismal science. That description came, I believe, from the work of Thomas Malthus some 200 years ago, in which he argued that population growth would dramatically outstrip agricultural production, leading to famine and social unrest. A very dismal conclusion, for sure. But I believe that economics continues to be referred to as a dismal science because economists basically annoy the daylights out of anybody who will listen to them. And I find that I can bring down a cocktail party quicker than any rainstorm or other malady I can think of. But I'm happy to hear from you on the annoyance factor or anything else that I may suggest to you today following my prepared remarks. And I would be happy to talk about any of the things that are going on in Washington and elsewhere relative to the recession. If you want copies of the slides, just leave me a business card and I will send those to you. I'd like to begin with a few words about our collective culture. Americans are a very independent and results-oriented people. In his classic work, Democracy in America, Tocqueville noted as long ago as 1835 that industriousness is our dominant ethic. In contrast to the aristocratic orientation of Europe, Tocqueville saw America as a place where hard work is the norm, striving for success is encouraged, and individualism as well as market capitalism flourish. That industriousness exhibits itself in numerous ways. Scientific advances, 309 Nobel Prizes have been won by Americans. Product introductions, 32,000 consumer products are introduced every year. Business formations, 650,000 plus firms start up annually. And it also is exhibited in our penchant for recognition and scorekeeping. More than 5,000 award ceremonies are held every year, and that's just in Hollywood. In our drive to move forward, to progress, we keep our eyes on the prize. We pursue goals and objectives. We seek closure. Our technologies are disruptive. Our leadership, transformative. But through this focus on ends, we have a tendency to emphasize ends at the expense of means. We favor decision over discussion, finality over comprehensiveness, and conclusion over certainty. This orientation is reflected in the increasing speed at which we feel compelled to function as a people. We need to get the answers and move on because we don't want to be left behind. Our attention span is reduced. And this is exhibited in things like the death of the newspaper, blogs, texts, tweets, and channel surfing. Increased mobility among communities, organizations, and professions. And our politicized view of the world. We need to know quickly whether individuals are with us or against us. Understanding the details of who they are and the nuances of their arguments can come later. We've also come to rely on what Curran and Sunstein refer to as the availability cascade. That's an economist's fancy way of saying that our beliefs, many of our beliefs, are formed and reinforced largely as a result of their continuing occurrence in public discourse. That is, the more we are exposed to certain ideas, the more legitimacy we grant those ideas, irrespective of whether they are based on facts and evidence or not. Now, one cost of this orientation that I wish to discuss with you over the next few minutes is an unfortunate tendency to repeat past mistakes because we sacrifice analytical thoroughness for decision-making expediency. And we frequently do so, in my opinion, in economic matters, where answers are often difficult to formulate, personally unsettling, politically unpalatable, or costly to implement. As a result, like Bill Murray in the 1993 movie Groundhog Day, we relive our experiences, in this case, our economic experiences. Even though we can never avoid all the economic dislocations that arise from the business cycle, we can prepare for and manage them more effectively. We can soften, shorten, and recover more quickly from future downturns by reducing the number of economic errors that we make. But to do this, we must take on the challenge of fashioning and implementing answers based on what we've learned. Contrary to Coleridge, the light which experience gives us need not be a lantern on the stern that shines only on the waves behind us. Now, let me give you a 30,000-foot rapid-fire PowerPoint unappealing recap of the recession. For some time, Congress had pushed for more mortgage lending, particularly to lower-income families. Much of this was through Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and the mandates of the Community Reinvestment Act. And to stimulate the economy following the deflation of the tech bubble in early 2000, the Federal Reserve lowered interest rates and kept them low. In order to create more mortgages, financial institutions competed for borrowers by offering ever more generous terms and increasingly packaged mortgage loans into derivative securities. And these could be sold to investors to make capital available for making yet more loans. These mortgage-backed securities, in which higher-risk loans were bundled with lower-risk loans, were rated as less risky than they actually were by agencies such as Moody's and Standard & Poor's, who got paid for those ratings. Low mortgage rates and aggressive underwriting stimulated housing purchases, and a real estate bubble inflated as demand pushed prices ever higher. When those prices began to fall in some areas, and some of the loans that were packaged into the derivative instruments went into default, the true risk of mortgage-backed securities became apparent, and investors began getting out of them in a hurry. And when investors and banks saw where things were headed, they moved to preserve their capital, as we would expect them to do. And those institutions that held key positions in the derivatives market, like Bear Stearns, or held or borrowed money to invest in mortgage-backed securities, or were perceived by investors as being risky, like Lehman Brothers, or who were aggressive mortgage lenders, like Countrywide, or who were using illegal schemes to make money in a hyperactive market, like Bernie Madoff, began disintegrating. Investors, firms, households started curtailing borrowing and spending, and economic activity slowed. Now, this added up to a larger-than-life problem, because aggressive lending, home construction and sales, and mortgage securitization had been going on for many years. and the housing bubble had grown to enormous size. The bubble led to a wealth effect that encouraged homeowners to spend by taking out home equity lines and planning to sell their homes at sizable margins, believing that the bubble would never subside. And because our economy is constructed around, its very foundation is lending money through the banking system. When banks stopped lending because they had so many of these bad loans on their books, it affected all major parts of the U.S. financial system. So let's see who's arguably at fault here. Well, the Federal Reserve under Greenspan for keeping interest rates too low too long. Home buyers who were unqualified for loans yet took them out anyway, believing they could flip their property. Mortgage lenders who gave people loans with little assurance that they could repay them. Rating agencies who failed to properly assess the risk of mortgage-backed securities. Investors who failed to exercise due diligence in researching their investments before committing to them. And regulators at the Federal Reserve, the FDIC, the SEC, and elsewhere who failed collectively to identify or address emerging problems. Congress for pushing lenders to create mortgages for people unable to afford them. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, who bought and backed home loans and raised capital based on an implicit guarantee that the government would bail them out, which turned out to be the case. So my position is there's a lot of blame to go around. Now, you might be thinking, I'm not a bank regulator or a member of Congress. I don't work for a rating agency. I didn't take out a ninja loan. Ninja is no income, job, or assets. So how does this relate to me? And it relates to you in the following way. Our macroeconomy is an aggregation of millions of decisions made every day. Through our inability to make our own microeconomically viable decisions, we create and contribute to our macroeconomic problems. As Walt Kelly once said, we have met the enemy, and he is us. Now, because the economy involves so many participants, any discussion of avoiding recessions could be a very long enterprise, as my students will attest. So, given the time available to us, I'd like to suggest two areas in which a better awareness of our individual contributions to the current situation would be of value in moderating the business cycle, and those are economic decision-making and what I call economic citizenship. On the first of these, economic decision-making, we no longer live in a time when economic questions are basic and few. Modern life requires that we have a baseline of economic knowledge and skills. Our increasingly sophisticated product and service transactions demand that we put more time and energy into making decisions that will be economically viable. I believe there are three keys to improving our microeconomic, that is, our personal economic decision-making: devoting the resources required for a decision, employing relevant information, and performing the proper analysis. I'll take each of these quickly in turn. Devoting the resources required. Some decisions can be made quickly and without significant effort. Those that are low cost and low risk. Those that involve short-term outcomes. You don't need to put a whole lot of time and energy into these because the result, if you err, is not significant. Other decisions, however, warrant a significant expenditure of time and effort. So it's important to put the proper amount of effort into a given decision based on its scale, importance, and risk. The more complicated the analysis, the more impactful or risky the outcome, the more time and thought and money, perhaps, you'll want to put into the decision. Think about this from the perspective of a major financial institution that is betting a significant part of its future earnings on mortgage-backed securities. How much time and energy should you spend when your bet on the outcome is so significant? Apparently, J.P. Morgan did the analysis. Citigroup and AIG did not. But it's the same basic decision analysis, even though the numbers are bigger and there are more of them, whether you're a Wells Fargo bank or the purchaser of a one-bedroom condo. Secondly, employing relevant information. Information is the essential ingredient for decision-making. Informational requirements increase as buyers and sellers become further separated from each other, both geographically and otherwise, when products, services, and relationships become more complicated, when products and relationships are more complicated, like software or engineering services or collateralized debt obligations, you can't hold such things in your hands. You can't take them apart. You can't even necessarily know exactly what they are until you purchase them. So you got to find other ways to get information about those things. An example is the role played by rating agencies such as Moody's and Standard & Poor's in the current recession. The information those agencies provide is crucial for investors. Now, unfortunately, Moody's and Standard & Poor's and similar rating agencies were conflicted. They want to sell their rating services to the creators of derivatives, but they also want to be objective in rating those derivatives. And they want to come up with ratings that enable their creators to sell the derivatives. That's a recipe for conflict. And those conflicts led to a widespread problem when investors believed that these mortgage-backed securities were of lower risk than they turned out to be. And the result contributed significantly to the economic downturn. Finally, perform the proper analysis. It's essential to determine what type of analysis is appropriate and how it's going to be performed. And you don't necessarily need to do it yourself. You can hire somebody, you can make use of others' research, you can get help from a trusted source. But whatever you do, you want to make sure that the analysis is proper, it's not partial or incomplete, and your decision options are clear. I think a good example is a home purchase. We know that many people jumped into the housing market in response to falling interest rates. And I would argue that a home purchase qualifies in every one of the three key decision-making areas I just listed. It involves your credit rating. It's a major use of capital, the largest purchase that most people make in their lifetimes. It provides benefits over time. It imposes costs over time. So, 30,000-foot review of home purchase decision. Economics enables prospective home buyers to understand that the cost of home ownership over and above the rent that would have been paid by you for an alternate place to live is the opportunity cost of not using that money for another purpose, like your retirement. Okay? So as a result, for many people, home ownership, particularly in the Bay Area, and I'm sorry to say this, has turned out to be a poor investment. Their retirement fund will be smaller as a result of going all in on a home purchase. Homes in demand cost of you over time. Repairs, maintenance, property taxes, larger utility bills, and capital gains that are not recovered in house price appreciation. So what is the basic analysis that you want to do here? You want to think about the capital gains that you realize when the home is sold. In other words, what do you make when you sell the house, less your total cost of owning that home versus the total investment gains and the cost of making those investments over the same period of time. That is the analysis for home ownership, according to an economist. Now, this is not to say that home ownership costs cannot be minimized or that you shouldn't buy a home. I bought a home. I'm an advocate of home ownership. Rather, it argues that economics gives us a slightly different perspective than we might have come up with on our own. Now, clearly, lenders should not have written mortgages based on sloppy underwriting, and they shouldn't have accepted borrowers' qualifying information that would have put their loans at risk. But countless borrowers also could not have afforded the mortgage that they took out, or could afford it only under conditions where they could flip the home quickly. And under bubble conditions, such as the housing market that we've been experiencing in the last couple of years, in the last many years, the availability cascade is magnified. We hear of others capitalizing on opportunities. We need to get those opportunities, too, for ourselves. Second example, personal investing. In every economic downturn, illegal and unethical activities are uncovered because they are based on using new investors' money to pay dividends to prior investors. So Ponzi schemes like Bernie Madoff's only work when there are relatively few withdrawals. But when the economy heads south, withdrawals are the order of the day and the scams come to light. Now, the history lesson here is that we fail to exercise due diligence in making our investments. Mr. Madoff is just a recent example. We should have learned from the Lloyd's of London syndicates in the 1980s, where American investors wanted to enjoy the status of being a Lloyd's name, and many were wiped out by reinsurance losses. And we should have learned from the meltdown of long-term capital management, which was established by Nobel laureates and had some amount of transparency behind it, but it reminds us that intelligence is not a substitute for managing investment risk. So here are five economic considerations for investing that could have benefited those who lost some of the estimated $50 billion that Mr. Madoff made off with. The seller's objective. No matter whether you're getting investment information from a stockbroker or an investment advisor, your brother-in-law or a television personality or an economics professor, what vested interest does this person have in the advice that he or she is giving you? How is this person compensated? Based on your gains, based on your transactions, based on an hourly advising basis? How is that person's involvement in this investment going to affect his or her objectivity? Total cost consideration. For any investment, what will your total cost be? Whenever I ask my new economic students to list all the costs that go into making a purchase or doing a transaction, they invariably leave things out. Why? Because many costs are not obvious. If you don't know what your costs are, then you can't possibly know what the return from any investment or purchase is going to be. Number three is the portfolio decision. Every investment has risk and return elements, as well as cost elements. Investments of greater risk generate larger returns because investors wish to be compensated for that added risk. But the risk of holding higher return investments can be reduced by diversifying and allocating one's portfolio. Now, this slide shows an example of how diversification and allocation have worked in a study of investment portfolios by Ibbotson Associates. Now, because stocks are a riskier investment than bonds, which everybody in this room knows, one would think that the portfolio on the right would generate its 8% return at greater risk than an all-bond portfolio on the left, because the right-hand portfolio is over half stock. But because the investments in the two portfolios are uncorrelated, the return is greater for the mixed portfolio than for the low-risk government bonds, but at the same level of risk. This is not common household knowledge, but it should be. The fourth consideration is what I call the power of C cubed. C cubed stands for continuous contributions and compounding. The power of modest but continuous contributions and compounding into a savings account or a stock plan or a mutual fund is extraordinary and completely underappreciated in our society. If a 20-year-old makes a one-time $5,000 investment and earns an average 8% annual return, that $5,000 will grow to $160,000 by age 65. If the same investor also contributes $5,000 annually for 45 years, his or her retirement savings will total nearly $2 million. This is the result of compounding, by letting the investment grow, by allowing contributions and interest to accrue. The second major point I wanted to bring to you today is a broader area of economic citizenship. Macroeconomic decisions and recessions are the result of aggregations of our individual decisions. Therefore, our better individual decisions are going to add up to better macroeconomic outcomes. However, we have an added responsibility, a societal or collective responsibility, and this is to fulfill our roles as economic citizens. In order to do so, we have to represent the collective interest by understanding the issues, making our views known, and seeking action if we believe it is necessary. So economic citizenship is taking economic knowledge and principles and applying it not only at a personal level, but at the societal level through our public roles. Citizen, voter, employee, consumer, investor, this is a long list. We practice economic citizenship through the public policy process, where we make our views known through voting, lobbying, contributing, and organizing. And you might be interested to know that very few of our legislators in either Sacramento or Washington have actual business experience or economic training. So we have an added responsibility to help educate them and inform them. Now, because stakeholders are critical for every organization's success, we have influence over the behavior of corporations and labor unions and nonprofits that we work for, work with, contribute to, and buy from. So let's take the corporate example. Customers provide the firm's revenue. That's pretty important to a firm. And they can make or break a firm's reputation. Investors provide growth capital, but they also have other places to put their investment dollars. Employees do the work, but they can, much of the time, choose who to work for. Suppliers provide essential business inputs and generally have more than one firm that they can support. These stakeholders have influence over the behavior of every business in this country. Dissatisfaction can be demonstrated individually by purchasing a competitive product, investing in another company, joining another firm. But the point is, we can exercise similar influence over any organization by voting against or for union proposals, by withholding charitable contributions or making contributions, and by pursuing common objectives through collective bargaining, product boycotts, block shareholding, private equity, and so forth. Unless you think this influence is minimal, it is often the case that a bigger price for operational or ethical lapses is going to be exacted by a firm's market and stakeholders, or a union's members and supporters, than by government, courts, or regulators. Stakeholders send a message to management that organizations ignore at their peril. The point is that we can influence the action of not only government but of business by voting with our wallet, our affiliations, and our shares. And the most effective involvement, whether through the political process or corporate governance, is based on an awareness of economic principles. As a result, one might argue that there is actually an upside to this or any economic downturn. It lies in the pressure it puts on us to recall and apply the longstanding economic principles that we ignore when times are good, to reach beyond the availability cascade by evaluating carefully, spending wisely, and maintaining a clear vision of what is important. Thank you.
You are listening to a Commonwealth Club talk by James Forcier. We will now welcome audience questions.
Thank you so much. This was very timely for me. In today's Chicago Sun-Times, there was a commentary of 10 reasons why the recession is already over. And yet PMI last month said that we've got another 2 years of falling real estate prices. Who do you believe? Especially when you have to act on some of this information.
That's a great question. One of the challenges that we all face, and particularly economists, is the variety and diversity of opinion that's out there about the economy. And I've gotten more than one question when I'm making public presentations about, isn't it true that the Austrian school predicted this downturn, or Nouriel Roubini, didn't he predict this, and so on and so forth. My academic feeling about this, and trying to be as objective as possible, is that these predictions, any prediction, you want to take with a grain of salt. You certainly want to add a dollop of who is making the prediction, just like in the investment advice I gave you. Who's actually saying this? What's their best interest and so forth? And basically, predictions, when you tear them apart or look back at actually what was said, are typically slightly different than what happened, even though we all want to take credit for being on the money. Now, compounding this problem is the fact that there are leading, lagging, and ongoing indicators of the economic situation. So I'm a reader of the Wall Street Journal, and every day, almost without fail for the last year, have been mixed messages. Oh, this looks like it's getting better, but then that's getting worse. I think there's common agreement around a few things. One is that unemployment is a lagging indicator. So firms are going to continue to do what they need to do in order to survive, and typically that means shedding jobs or avoiding hiring, until they have some assurance that they're going to be able to sustain the costs that they bear by bringing workers back on. In other words, their production looks like it's going to increase or starts to increase. They can see the light at the end of the tunnel. They then want to hire up and embrace the costs that are necessary in order to meet that production. Okay, so that's certainly one thing to keep in mind. The real estate market, I've heard various predictions. I feel, kind of looking at all the data, they were pretty close to a bottom in terms of real estate prices. Now, real estate markets are local. So what happens in San Francisco is not the same thing as what happens in Southern California or in Arizona or anywhere else. And some markets, how can I put this delicately, have been heroically developed with the thought that whatever you produce could be consumed. Well, we're finding the problem with that, because a lot of that was speculation based on the fact that interest rates would remain low and people would continue to want to purchase homes in these areas. So I think real estate is probably nearing a bottom. And it looks like from the GDP figures, although once again, you take this with a grain of salt, it looks like we may have, maybe very close to the bottom in terms of GDP loss. So from the peak until today, about 3.9% loss of GDP. But from the last report that we got, you're not going to like this, and they're continually revised as soon as they come out. But nevertheless, it looks like the angle of loss, the direction of loss, is subsiding. So it looks like we're really nearing the bottom in terms of GDP losses, which is a good sign, because GDP is the ultimate indicator of macroeconomic health. We need to be growing again as an economy. So if you put all that stuff together and you read as much nonsense as well as quality input as I have, my belief is that we are near the bottom. It's going to take us some time to work through it. And there's the remaining huge question is, are consumers going to continue saving versus spending? And how quickly is unemployment going to be extinguished so that we can get onto a strong growth path? Hard to say, but some people believe the trajectory is longer than others. That's a very long answer. I think we're on the mend. I think the outlook is good, but it's probably going to take us a couple years to work through some of the problems we've got.
You mentioned that it's upon the citizens to make responsible decisions and good economic decisions. But as we saw in the housing market, if somebody gives you 0% down loan, you have basically infinite return on investment, possibly, and zero risk. So it seems like we need to have better regulation in the banking industry so this sort of thing doesn't happen.
I am not so far out in the free market that I don't see a role for regulation. I think the like other economic matters, it's a little more complicated than just picking out a few culprits and saying all we need to do is fix a few of these institutions or the way they do what they do, and we're going to avoid problems like this in the future. And I'll give you a couple reasons why that is. One of them is, as I mentioned in my remarks, economics, macroeconomics, is highly politicized. There is extraordinary unanimity in the academy about what needs to be done in any given situation. The likelihood that that unanimous conclusion is going to be put into effect by Congress is zero. Okay? So the challenge is, how do you, we know we needed stimulus, for example. The question then becomes, how do we actually implement that stimulus? So if you're from a state that has a lot of auto manufacturing, say, you're going to want to make sure that something happens positively for your constituents who are suffering from the auto manufacturing meltdown. Might that be the right thing in the eyes of all economists looking at the economy in aggregate? Well, maybe not. If you're from Wisconsin or California, you have a lot of dairy and agricultural products, you're going to want to make sure that those industries are protected. Is that going to get the most stimulus into those areas? Possibly not. The worst outcome that I fear is characterized by something I heard a regulator say after having been scolded for not doing the correct things. And his response was, well, we're going to add more staff and resources and we're going to do even more of this stuff. Well, that's, you're missing the question. You're missing the point. It's not that you need to do more of what you're doing. It's that you need to do something else. This is where we have a role to play. If you believe that the stimulus package is going in the wrong direction, or that there should be tax relief, or whatever it is that you believe in, I encourage you to get involved in the process. And it could be going to town hall meetings. It could be writing your legislator. It could be writing letters to the editor. Whatever it is that you feel you need to do. But the sad truth is there are going to be political winners and losers. The regulatory process is going to be cherry-picked relative to which agencies can be changed, which agencies are willing to be changed, what's politically palatable, what plays into electoral politics and all that kind of stuff. It may not be the right answer. And the reason why I emphasize you're getting involved is you need to make sure that the answers are the best that they can be.
You had mentioned the conflict that the rating agencies have because they get paid by the people whose securities they're rating. What's a better model that would give them, that would give us the public more honest evaluations?
Boy, that is a very difficult question. It's not unlike the earlier question relative to investment advice coming out of firms that have a vested interest in you buying stocks or bonds or other securities. And I don't, I honestly don't have a simple answer for that. But I will tell you where the answer lies, and that is we need to alter the incentives and disincentives of these agencies. If you have them, if you're reliant on your customers to be paid for a product that you are producing, you're going to listen to those customers first, which is the way it should be in a free enterprise economy. You want to listen to those customers. The problem is that it's not just the customers that benefit or suffer from the rating agency's opinions. It's also investors like everybody in this room. The incentives and disincentives need to be realigned. It's not clear to me exactly how that's going to be done. There's a lot of discussion now on the part of the regulatory bodies and elected officials and the securities industry about what should be done about that. I'm trusting that they're going to use some good basic economics. And once again, I would encourage you to follow the debate closely. And if it looks like it's not going to lead to an outcome that you realize is required, to make your voice heard.
Professor, unemployment, can you give us your view on unemployment? Have we peaked out? If not, when and how high? Thank you.
Thank you for the softball questions. That also is difficult to say, and I'll tell you why. It's our economy is an aggregation of consumers and businesses and regulators and so forth. And every business is in a unique market, has unique costs and revenue objectives and so forth. So to be able to say, broad brush, that we know exactly when unemployment is going to turn up, employment's going to improve, you would have to have some fantastical knowledge of what all these firms are doing. I don't think that's possible. We can make guesses. We can make guesses. The most recent reasonable guesses have discussed a peak of around 10%. But in California, you're going to see some differences. In Michigan, you're going to see some differences relative to that. Obviously, we've gotten hit in different ways and harder. I really don't have a whole lot more I can contribute to that debate, except to say that I believe that the GDP figures are very encouraging in terms of our ability to not transcend that 10% cap.
You had a slide up there that compared risk for investment in bonds and investment in stocks. The conclusion is kind of counterintuitive. Since the return on bonds is less, why is not the risk less?
The reason is because of the if you take either one of those investments by itself, you may expect a certain return. But when you put those investments together, they offset each other. Now, there's a couple of caveats. One of them is you can't expect this to happen overnight. So markets are going to do what they do. They go up and down over time. They have some volatility built into them. Bonds have almost no volatility. Stocks have a good deal. But if you hold them over an extended period of time, the fact that these two investment types are uncorrelated means that when times are good, the stocks are going to grow, and you're going to get a healthy return from that. When times are bad, you're going to be saved by the bonds that are steady as she goes. Okay? The one reason why I put that slide up there is because it's not intuitive. That's why I love the slide. And that's why, frankly, that's why economics is interesting. If everything were intuitive, we'd all be wealthy, right? We'd all live in Beverly Hills or whatever. But it's not. And this is the value of understanding economics. Now, in any given time period, you may not see these uncorrelated assets doing what they need to do to balance out your portfolio, okay? So one of the linchpins to this is you have to hold this stuff over a long enough period of time. However, Ibbotson and others have demonstrated conclusively, in my opinion, that you're much better off having a diversified and asset-allocated portfolio than trying to guess the market, which is the alternative. So I'm going to put it all in, or going all into bonds and finding out 40 years from now that you missed a huge amount of earnings that you could have realized.
Looking at your causes of the recession slide that you had, one of the things that you mentioned was the Community Reinvestment Act and Congress encouraging investment in communities that hadn't received lots of investment mm-hmm. before. And then you also talked about market deregulation and other financial actors being able to get in and do things that banks traditionally had been only allowed to do. So what I would like to hear is just some sense of the magnitude or, you know, which came first, the chicken or the egg. From my take of it, I see deregulation is what let the horse out of the barn as opposed to any sort of altruistic intention of Congress.
What I tried to do in those two busy slides was to try to express my very strong belief that there was a whole lot of things that contributed to this downturn, and not just one or two, particularly one or two that are politically expedient to go after. There's a lot of contributions. Now, CRA. CRA by itself, I would say this is not a notable contributor to the recession. What was a notable contributor was the fact that there was a lot of inertia behind giving more and more loans to people. Giving loans to people of modest means is a wonderful thing. However, giving loans to anybody that walks in the door pushes that to another extreme. And why did that happen? Because of active competition on the part of the banks who wanted to fight with each other to get as many of those loans as they possibly could. So pretty soon you had no documents, almost nothing, demonstrating that, in fact, you could afford that loan. Now, to me, and I think looking back, that's kind of pushing the whole concept over the edge. It says if giving loans to people of modest means is good, then having no qualifying whatsoever must be great so we can do more and more loans. Well, obviously, we went a little bit too far. I think the whole philosophy behind CRA is a good one. The Federal Reserve has been, I think, a strong advocate of that. And there's no question that homeownership and all that goes along with it builds strong communities, encourages people to make a greater than personal investment in where they live, and that is all to the good. The problem is we took it too far. Now, in terms of deregulation, once again, that's a balancing act. To the extent that we say we need to regulate these people so that they no longer do creative things in the in financing and the credit markets, that's when we're going to have some real problems. You don't want that font of creativity to dry up. So if we do get involved in greater regulation, we have to make sure we are doing it in a balanced way and that we're actually going after the regulations that will make a difference. We don't do anything more than we have to that is going to stifle creativity and enterprise in the financial sector.
Back to the Standard, I'm over here, okay. Standard & Poor's and Moody's problem. Those institutions have been around for a very long time, therefore that conflict of interest has been around for a long time. Has it not, that conflict not presented itself to society before, or have we forgotten that the conflict exists? Because I was stunned by the fact that these things got rated the way they did.
Well, it's clear that it hasn't existed in the way that it did most recently. And once again, we're talking about a confluence of multiple factors. If the mortgage-backed security products were only a very small part or a modest part of the overall financing world involving mortgage loans, mortgage lending, this wouldn't have been an issue. It probably wouldn't have even showed up. But as it turns out, the race to do more and more loans meant that the financial institutions that wanted to do these mortgage loans were pushing further and further to get mortgages packaged up and off their books so they could engage in more lending. And so I think you make a wonderful point, which is what can we learn from what we've experienced in the past, if anything, relative to this? But the problem, of course, is we didn't know we had this problem until we had this problem. So I don't know. I think it's a great idea to take a look and see what might have popped up in the past relative to this, but we may not find all the answers because this is such a different animal, particularly in terms of scale. We just never seen anything like this before.
Yes, the title of your talk is Why Do We Keep Making the Same Mistakes? And probably one of the most important books I read in college, Annette 101, many have, is I can't exact the title, but something about popular delusions of the crowds and the madness of masses. And he goes back to the South Sea Island bubble and the Mississippi scheme and tulipomania. Yep. And I think my opinion is it's just something intrinsic with human nature, avarice or whatever, that we're going to have repeated booms and busts unless we change human nature. It ain't going to happen.
We are always going to have what used to be referred to as business cycles, the periodic waxing and waning of the economy. Obviously, this thing that we're coming out of now is not just your regular old garden variety business cycle. So that is a thing that I think economists spend the most time concerning themselves with. We can accept a little bit of volatility, a little bit of up and down as we go, but we certainly can't stomach this stuff. Now, you make a really good point, and it's sort of a worrisome comment on human nature and on our behavior as human beings. I read recently that, and this may have now changed a little bit, that we actually spend more money gambling than saving in this country. I find that to be absolutely frightening. Now, the question becomes, what do we do about it? And we, as I talked about at the beginning, we're an independent people. We love our freedom. We love our business starts and our ability to do things. And so we can't put people in a cage and say, thou shalt not, you know, go to Las Vegas versus put your money into a savings fund. On the other hand, we want people to take stock of the importance of their decisions and to make better ones. And the only conclusion that I've been able to come up with so far is education. And you might say, well, gosh, you know, yeah, you're an educator, so that's obvious. But the problem is I haven't really found anything that fits the bill as well as information, education, encouraging people to get assistance if they need it and advice if they need it and encouraging them to be more responsible for their own behavior. It's not simply a matter of saying Washington can come in and fix this, because it can't. It's we have to fix it.
We're at the point in our program where we have time for just one more question. Does anyone... one occurs to me on the education. I wonder in particular what you think about undergraduate education in this respect. Should there be more requirements perhaps for economic education?
Oh, boy. I told you this was a dismal science, and I'm about to make enemies of every educator who hears this broadcast. I worry about the fact that, particularly at the undergraduate level, many of the things that were prerequisites when I was an undergrad are no longer required. And I think even more than that, we don't teach basic economics as a mandatory requirement at the undergraduate level. And it separates us from, I would argue, most developed Western nations. In Europe, it is common for people to have more economics than my upper division undergrads come in with, just basically starting in high school. So much of this stuff is second nature to them. And I wonder how different our world would be if people had some courses, basic courses in economics, before they went on to decide on a profession or a specific career path. I think our world would be different, and arguably we wouldn't have as many of these serious recessions. Now, maybe that's fantasy on my part, but certainly I think it's something worth exploring.
Our thanks to James Forcier, Dr. James Forcier, Assistant Professor at the University of San Francisco and Managing Director of Bay Analytics, for his well-organized and very informative presentation today. We also thank our audience here and on radio. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, marking its 106th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.